Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is backing off his threat to boycott peace talks with Israel until a truce is reached with militants in the Gaza Strip. Those peace talks are a big focus of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's trip to the region. She's meeting with Israel's defense and foreign ministers today. Secretary Rice arrived in the region days after rocket fire out of Gaza mobilized Israel's military to go into the Strip. More than 100 residents were killed and Palestinian leaders suspended talks. Now, there's one person who's not going to be chasing her around today for an interview. It's NBC News veteran foreign correspondent Martin Fletcher, who writes this in the introduction of his new book, Breaking News. I am proud to say that I have rarely interviewed a head of state or a CEO. I don't care what the generals have to say, and don't get me started on the royal family. Nobody with a story to sell or a policy to spin interests me. What I care about are the people who pay the price. Fletcher's bio sums up his remarkable career like this. He's covered every event of consequence in the Middle East and Africa for the last 30 years. Of course, this includes a famine in Somalia, the Yom Kippur War, Kosovo. But perhaps in a show of sheer will, he is living through what is known as the book tour. And Martin Fletcher joins us in studio. It's so nice to see you.
Hi, Alice. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Usually, Martin and I still work for NBC part-time, but I worked there full-time, and it was always through a two-way. So it is a pleasure to meet you in real life, not through just an earpiece. I want to start with Israel, obviously, because we have a little bit of news there today. You know, in your book, you say at one point, after covering the Middle East and living in Tel Aviv for some time, it occurred to you that, quote, the divide was not really between Israeli and Arab, Jew and Muslim, or even right and wrong. The divide was between those who put peace above all else and those who didn't. Can we talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
I came to that realization, actually, through one woman whose daughter was killed. And when I spoke to her, she said that the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, who was an old school friend of hers, called to express condolences, and she wouldn't speak to him. She refused to speak to him, even though he was a friend and the prime minister, and because she said he's one of the guys who made this happen indirectly, through not compromising, not being willing to compromise, and that's how she saw the whole conflict. She had many Palestinian friends who wanted to compromise, but the leaders weren't taking them in that direction, and that was sort of a revelation for me when I understood. You know, it's not really about the positions and the policies; it's just simply about the people and what they want.
So when you hear the Secretary of State, what she wants to try to accomplish today and before the end of the administration, I can imagine you sort of can only nod towards that and say, all right, well, at least it's worth a try. But the reality is,
ain't going to happen.
Ain't going to happen.
Ain't right? going to happen.
I'd like to ask you to read a passage from your book, because it is very descriptive and it really can put the reader at the scene of just one of the many events that you covered. Would you mind turning to page 178?
Okay. I got it.
All right. Let's start at We Drove Our Jeeps.
Okay. Is this a test?
I believe you that you wrote this book.
This is because of my accent, isn't it?
Well, yeah, exactly. Your English accent is much better than my Jersey accent reading this.
Okay. Here we go. Rwanda. Okay. We drove our jeeps along muddy trails through lush green hills and thick bush, past children with machetes and men with spears, until we arrived around midday at an open field of scrub and head-high elephant grass that stretched to the horizon, with scraggy bushes and a single large tree in the distance. I looked on in amazement. It was as if you'd taken several football stadiums of people and dumped them outside town, way outside. A quarter of a million people stood or lay aimlessly on the ground as dark clouds gathered overhead. Some had constructed cover from sticks and grass. Most had no shelter or food. The only water available came from a nearby animal watering hole, where dirty scum was already collecting on the surface. Smoke from the campfire stung the eyes, and the air carried the piercing, choking smell of feces and sweat. These were the refugees who had crossed the bridge in the 24 hours that it was open, a small window of opportunity between the fleeing Rwandan army abandoning the border post and the Tutsi rebels closing in. Aid agencies were already overwhelmed, and tens of thousands more refugees were said to be waiting inside Rwanda, desperate to escape.
Did you keep a diary at this time, or are these kind of images just in your memory forever?
Actually, both.
Yeah.
I kept diaries, and when I came across remarkable moments over the years, I would write it as if I was writing. I used to write long letters to my parents, and that was actually the main source.
Hmm.
And you know, when you look back on these moments, it just comes back. And I actually have a lousy memory, but but these moments, just you just see them again.
In discussing Rwanda, which you do very, very candidly in the book, you wrote that for the first time in your career, you'd come upon a scene of human suffering you couldn't stomach, couldn't film, and couldn't witness. You decided to leave a camp in Goma, this particular refugee camp. Why?
It was exactly as you say. It was just too, for me, I don't know. It's the only time that's ever happened to me. The scene was of a nurse at dawn walking through a field. Smoke was rising. Smoke was rising through the mist. The floor was crammed with people and bodies calling for help, and the nurse in a white uniform was just walking among them, looking down. And I saw a guy looking up, and I saw her looking down. And I just, for me, I just had this extraordinary instant connection with the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust. And I thought, this is what it was like. And I just couldn't see it because my family was in the Holocaust. I'd never been able to identify. And that was a moment where I just made the connection between, oh, my God, this is what it was like for my family and people like them, millions of people like them. And so I just said to the cameraman, hey, you know. And the cameraman said, oh, great shot. And I said, no, let's just keep going.
You discuss that a lot in the book, that your professional instinct of, oh, this is an amazing story, we should film it, and then the human instinct of, what are we really filming? Did you struggle with that throughout your career?
I didn't. In the beginning, I came to.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, I was just, I called myself in the book a clueless adventurer.
Your first chapter just says clueless. When I thought, what is this?
It wasn't too far from the truth. I was having a great time. And then I went to Africa for 4 years and had a party, you know. And it was a 4-year party. But at a certain point, you just realize what you're seeing. You know, you grow up. And I grew up to this background of awful stuff. So there's one example in particular in Somalia when Tom Brokaw said to me, go do a story on what's it like to die of starvation. And my producer said, oh, well, let's go ask a doctor. And I said, no, let's go film someone dying of starvation. And we filmed a young woman, Fida Ibrahim, from the moment she was collected from the hut, and we stayed with her until she literally died on camera of starvation. And that was a horrible thing to do, I thought, at the time. And I was really agonizing over, is this the right thing to do? This has to be the wrong thing. The last thing this dying girl is going to see is a camera on a tripod looking at her with the sound man wiping his brow saying, God, it's hot in here. It was terrible, but at the same time, I understood this was a really powerful moment and a powerful way to tell the story, and I hoped the story would do some good. And that particular story assumed a life of its own. It was used in fundraising, raised loads of money, and I hoped that it helped more people than it harmed. But it was hard to do.
I bet it was. We're talking to Martin Fletcher, a veteran NBC News correspondent who's written a new book called Breaking News. In facing death yourself, we'll get into one of those stories in just a minute, but also witnessing others' deaths. Did it bleed into your personal life? You're a husband, you're a father.
It didn't, because I would go home and beat the wife.
And then she'd smack you back.
Just kidding.
And kick the kids. Just kidding. No,
I've seen her. She looks tough. I don't think you can take her.
I would go home and my wife would say, from Sarajevo or somewhere, and she'd say, so how was it? And I'd say, it was okay. And that was the end of it. We didn't really discuss it. You know, I didn't really, despite the fact I'd written a book like this, I never told war stories.
Is she in the business?
She was a stills photographer, actually, at one point. Now she's an artist.
You know, there's a certain spirit about foreign correspondence, which I think Rachel can attest to, that there's a thrill, there's a rush, there's a lot of adrenaline because you're going to extraordinary places. And we were all sort of, there's lots of pictures of you standing on tanks. On the cover, you're standing on the tank, and inside, there's one where you look like Andy Gibb standing at attack, like one of the Bee Gees. Souvenirs like this, are they important to you in the field? Do they bring you back? And why are you standing on a tank, Martin, so much?
Yeah, more to the point, Martin. Why are you standing on a tank?
What's with the tank? Good point. No answer. Stupid.
But don't you think there is a lot of, especially when you're younger, there's a lot of ego involved in that work? You know, you're seeing really important things.
Most of the times I'm on the tanks, in my defense, I'm posing in a ridiculous way.
This is true.
I don't know. I think sea tank, jump on. It's almost instinctive, especially if you're a guy. You know, most people say sea tank, get out of the way.
Yeah.
I was just drawn to those things, but I'm not in the slightest bit militaristic, and I couldn't, for the life of me, tell you what kind of a tank that is. I don't care. I don't know. So, I don't know. You know, it is a boy thing, isn't it? You know, you go to war, but at a certain point, you grow up, and the harm and the damage and the terror and the fear and all the rest of it. takes over rather quickly from the thrill. But sure, you know, covering war is a big kick.
There's until you come upon literally a field of mines. There's this one story you tell about, I believe you're in Cyprus, and you're driving along in your Jeep, and all of a sudden you realize you're in the middle of a minefield. How did you end up in the middle of a minefield? Was that just, were you being too cavalier? Were you too young to know better? As you look back now.
Actually, at the time, I was young, but I did know better. But what happened was the BBC cameraman was tired. The BBC asked me to work with them that day, so I went with them. And normally I take all decisions myself. But at that time I thought, well, I'm with the Beeb, let them decide. And they said, hey, let's turn right up this road. And I said, I think there was mines up in this area. And they said, no, it's okay. And we drove along. And there were three cars following our car, which is a convoy, which I hate. And we just at some point realized those black things that we're just driving over are landmines. And we stopped the car. In fact, the driver, very coolly, Simon Dring, maneuvered the car past a couple of landmines, and we were in the middle of the minefield, and the other cars were not. So we sort of sat back and thought, this is bad. And then the last car in the convoy, a couple of guys from the New York Times, pulled out. And that's why I hate convoys, because whenever the first one stops, the guy at the back will always say, hey guys, what's up, why have you stopped? And that's what they did. So my sound man, Ted Stoddart, got out of the car and shouted them, get back, and he trod in the landmine. So he was killed, standing right next to me. He was about 3 feet from me. Mm-hmm. I was thrown onto the correspondent by the blast. The correspondent got out on the other side of the car to go try and help, and he hit a landmine too, so he was badly wounded. And then there were like all these other guys in the car. I mean, it's so stupid. They still continued to go forward. Somebody else trod on a landmine, a friend of mine, Paul Rock. And in the end, one was killed and seven were wounded. And I got out of the car. I was a cameraman then. And I mean, after a bit, I understood, oh, my God, I filmed all this. I had the camera out, and I was filming the whole scene. So at the end, the wounded left, and I was left with Ted, who was dead, and Simon, who was wounded. And then I had to walk out of the minefield myself with my camera for protection.
So after a day like that, what makes you show up to work the next day?
The next day, I went back to the same place to go film it, to make sure that I wouldn't be... that I would be able to keep going, you know, fall off a horse and go riding again. Mm-hmm. So that I literally forced myself the next day to go back to the same place and have a look at it and keep going.
Is there one story that you haven't covered that you wish you'd been there?
Oh, that's a good question. You know what? Let me answer that kind of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. I always wonder whether if there were cameras at the Holocaust, things would have been different. I mean, I'm not the only person to wonder that. And I believe that the cameras would not have made any difference because the Germans wouldn't allow the cameramen to film. And in the same way, you can't film in certain plot in, say, in Rwanda during the killing there, or in Kosovo during the ethnic cleansing, or in many parts of Iraq because it's too dangerous. So I would have loved to have wandered those areas with a camera and seen what that would have done to history. But realistically, the Germans would have just arrested me and beat me up and thrown me out.
Martin Fletcher is the author of a new book. It's called Breaking News. He's NBC News Bureau Chief in Tel Aviv. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming by the studios. It was a pleasure to see you in real life.
Thanks, Allison. Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, Martin. That does it for this hour of the Bryant Park Project. We don't go away, though. We're on your computers all the time, npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks so much for listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.